Hello, everybody. Welcome to podcast number 53 of the Alexi Sale podcast. And this is part two of our lengthy interview with Lee Mack. Now, it gets quite granular, I think. It gets quite into the kind of weeds of the professional business of being a comedian. But I think that it's none the worse for that. I think that that's what podcasts are for, in a sense, this long form is to, you know, if you're interested in comedy, then you're listening to somebody, somebody who's really, you know, a huge, huge star, but talking very simply and analytically about how he's got to that point. You know, somebody who's got both a hit sitcom, a hit Saturday night quiz show, and a hit comedy panel show, you know, and it's while managing to remain a relatively normal person, which is, you know, which of those things is probably the most massive achievement of all, really. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, have you got anything to say about that to add?
Well, no, he's nailed every aspect of the comedy path of the big star, really.
And yeah, I think if you're a student of, you know, studying comedy or, you know, whatever,
whether like how to do it in a
an amateur, then there's a tremendous amount to be derived from his professionalism, really, and from his working method, I think, which is
just he's done it in a genuine way, and he's never. I can't think of a. You know, say what you want about Lee Mack, but I don't think he's ever been a bastard.
No, I think that's unlikely to
there's be anybody. Other comics at his level who have all sorts of scandal, and Lee Mack's not one of them, man.
No,
just a lovely family man who's pretty cool guy.
Yeah, so let's get on with it. Lee Mack, part two. What were you doing on telly then? Because I mean, I remember
I started to do what I really wanted to do, which was be on the circuit.
Right.
Crack that circuit. Because even though I'm telling you before, I did four gigs on a Saturday night. That's not how it started out. I was doing four gigs in 3 months or 4 months to begin with, because it's hard being an open spot. You know, you have to push yourself, ring up, and can I have another gig? But I got fortunate in that it was still, in comparison to what it became, smaller. There was every comedian knew each other.
Right.
That has gone. Like, there's every comedian's on different genres now, or different mediums. Some are on YouTube, some are on telly, some are on circuit. Within the circuit, there's probably different circuits. There's Edinburgh, it's so broken up, and there's so many now, you know. But back then, I was just trying to do my bit on this. And that's all I wanted, to be a circuit comic. And couple of years in from doing that, I just got offered. I was doing Edinburgh as well, but Edinburgh for me was about, I don't know what it was about really. I suppose it was, well, look, it was about doing competitions really. I was new enough that I was going to Edinburgh to enter competitions and be, there's a show called So You Think You're Funny, there was a BBC Comedy Awards. I was doing the early versions of them, you know. That's why I went up to Edinburgh. And then I just got offered this show on Channel 4 where I was the host, called Cass, and it was in the late 90s, and I'm supposed to host these new comics, even though I hadn't even been doing it 2 years. I was so scared. I was like, I can't do that. I am a new comic, you know, and I'm hosting other new comics.
Right.
But people, I think it was Peter Kay's first telly show, and I introduced him, and the Mighty Boosh came on. Not as the Mighty Boosh, they were individual stand-ups back then. Noel and Julian were on it, Tommy Tien came on it. So looking back, it did introduce, you know, new acts that then went on to much bigger things. But I wasn't ready for it. I really wasn't. In fact, I did it the wrong way around. What that did was help me get established on the circuit.
Because
everyone knew who I was on the circuit. I'd been doing it 2 years. But I think it got my foot in the door in some of the clubs in London. Like, well, I suppose you might book him. He's been on the telly.
Yeah.
I still knew. I wasn't ready for it. I look back at that show and I realised I really wasn't ready for it. You know, I just didn't have I only had a 15-minute act, a 20-minute act. Just about had a 20-minute act.
Right, so what did you do for material?
Well, all they did was they said, this is what we've got, a writer that can help me called Dominic Holland. You know Dominic? He's a circuit comic.
Yeah.
Was at the time.
He's done lots of... And his son, of course, is Spider-Man.
Before he was Spider-Man's dad.
Yeah.
He's a great comic, and he's written books, and he's got quite a mix of things he does, you know. But he was very much what I wanted to be. He was a regular Comedy Store John Lewis act.
Yeah.
And I wasn't. And here he is having to write for the new lad, you know. And he made it very clear. And I'm a good mate of Donald. I'm really loving some mates. And he just made it clear. I didn't know him at the time. I walked in and he said, I'm just going to make it clear. So, you know, I'm doing this for the money. All right. He says, I don't really know what you do, you know. So I gave him a VHS tape of me playing some gig in Bristol, I think. I'd recorded on a big fat camera that I think I'd got from the uni that I was at. And I gave it to him. He says, right, well, I'll go and watch that and see what you do. Terrified all night. I said to my, before phones, he couldn't text me or anything, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't even know him. I said to my missus, what's he going to think? What's he going to think? I come in the next day for the writers' meeting. I went, you seeing it? He goes, yeah. Oh, what do you think? And I remember him just going, I've got quite a lot of work on with it. Like, he was right. If I had a 15-minute act, of which maybe half of it was usable on the telly, the rest wouldn't work in a 3-minute section or a 2-minute section.
Right.
We just got to work. He wrote me material with me. I did a lot of my own writing, but he helped me a bit. We got through a series, you know, with, and I looked back and realised I was cutting my teeth, and it was...
Yeah, I mean,
I did my best, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the game is. Nobody appears fully formed, do they? I mean, it's really like...
It was too early to go on telly, though.
Yeah. But that's... I mean, in a way, that's even that...
But how long had you been doing it? When you were like, I don't know, in the young ones, how long had you been a comic? I suppose you couldn't have been longer.
2 years.
2 years, because you were starting out. When you started off, was that...
Comedy Store was 79.
What were you doing before 79?
I was like washing dishes and shit like that.
The 79 was the first.
No, I'm being slightly. I was in like a theatre group.
Right, so you had performed.
But
you hadn't done stand up.
Not as such. No, not what you call stand up. It was just me and this other guy did a kind of sketch. No, I invented it.
Yeah, yeah.
So everybody owes me a fucking royalty.
Well, this is why I'm doing this.
Yeah,
I didn't realise that turned up. It was for free, but I'll tell you. No, but it is true, you know.
We were a sketch act, and I would step out of the sketches and do bits.
But
it wasn't. Nobody understood what it was.
But it's interesting, isn't it? How you've been. Like when I think of you in the young ones doing stand up, that's what you were doing.
Yeah,
you came on as this East European landlord. Yeah. And then just suddenly turn and change accents and and then do this voice and go, oh, he's like a stand-up now. Then no one questioned it. But of course, that's what perhaps you've done in the things pre-sale.
Really witty. Yeah, well, I did 79 was the comedy store lasted from 79 to 80. Then 80 to 81 was the comic strip club, which was me and Rick and Aidan, Dawn and Jennifer and Peter and Nigel.
And where was that?
That was in Raymond's Review Bar.
That has nothing to do with the Comedy Store.
No, it was in a different strip club.
Oh, right.
Also in Soho, because Peter felt it was important that it was in a strip club as well.
Really?
Yeah. Just to have that kind of vibe, you know. The original Comedy Store was also was a strip club,
yeah.
A topless bar.
It's weird, isn't it? It's such a weird...
It's hard to...
It's supposed to be just... Getting rid of all the old school sexism, and I was going to do it in a strip club.
Yeah, and we didn't see anything the least bit.
No, but you need that atmosphere as well for that.
We felt that we needed that sleazy atmosphere, yeah. So that was 80 to 81. Then we went on the road, we went to Australia in 82, and then we made the young ones. We'd made the pilot before we went to Australia. And then we made the rest of the young ones in 82. I mean, ridiculously short time span, really.
Yeah.
But we were so confident, you know, I think.
Yeah, but also just like now, if you did the young ones now, you know that, half a million people would see.
Yeah, yeah.
Television is so broken up.
And it was but 5 or 6 million.
I mean, that's huge, right?
Yeah.
That
must
be hard to handle.
But also by, like, because I'd also done this other late night show called OTT.
Oh, yeah.
With
Chris Terrence.
Yeah, Lenny Henry.
Yeah, of course.
I'd done that in from 82, I'd done that from January to March 82, and then we went to Australia with the comic strip. But I was already playing 1,000 seaters by, so that'd be a year, 2 years after I'd started doing, I'd started become a comic.
So that's
I was what, already playing 1,000 seaters, 2,000 seaters.
It's interesting, isn't it, how different our worlds were, because you did 2 years, you're on the telly, you're playing 1,000 seaters.
Yeah.
I did 2 years, did my Channel 4 show, Gas, and said to my missus, and this wasn't ego, this was practicality, I thought. We sat outside this restaurant when I got the call on the first ever version of a mobile phone saying, you've got this Channel 4 show. And I remember saying to her, wow, we might not be able to do this sitting outside a restaurant. And that wasn't, honestly, I didn't feel egotistical.
Yeah.
I felt it was a practical thing to say to her.
Yeah.
I'm going to be on the telly,
right?
And that's going to have an effect on our lives, you know. Cut to me, probably 3 months after that, the television show had been made and broadcast very quickly, doing my first solo stand-up show at Edinburgh, booked in because I thought, well, I've no problem selling this.
Yeah.
I've been on Channel 4 now. Opening night, 4 people turned up. And it didn't get much better for the run. That being on the telly then, suddenly counted for very little in terms of selling tickets.
Yeah.
And that was probably the difference between being in the early 80s
and
the early 90s.
Yeah.
That because suddenly
that's there was all
a lot more happening.
Yeah.
There was a lot of millions of comedians at Edinburgh.
Because I mean, once I was on the once OTT went out, I couldn't go into the Central Liverpool, for instance. I never went into the Central Liverpool again for like 20 years because it wasn't
got to handle, right? I guess
it was complicated. It was because
everything you wanted, everything you hated.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, more one. I loved being famous. I thought it was because I was such a weirdo that I just loved being famous. But that thing you had to. You had to watch yourself. There's somewhere like Liverpool, you had to, if you couldn't go into the centre because it would get very dodgy very quickly, really. Yeah. And that was, just something you accepted, but it was, I guess in retrospect, it was kind of fucked up, you know, but just the way it was.
But also, I guess not part of the plan as well. In terms of, it can't be a plan, it's happened that quickly. 2 years, you're playing 1,000 seaters and it's, From your first gig, having that kind of attention, there's not been much training, right? At least mine's been quite slow.
Yeah.
So I've had, I mean, I remember the first time it started happening to me and feeling weird about it, but you don't know what to do. Like, my version of that is when I would always be with my girlfriend in a shop and not be recognised.
Yeah.
And she'd just go over there and pay for something or go and have a look at a dress, and then I'd be recognised. Because you're on your own now, and he's on his own. I can talk to him now, and they'd go away, and she'd come back over. I go, I should be recognised. This would happen a few times, and she'd go, I think you're being a bit delusional. I go, honestly, when she would walk away, that they would talk to her. So there's this weird thing where she's starting to go, are you making this? Like, I swear to God, come here. You just put front to me, didn't you? It was this really weird, you know.
Right.
And I remember jamming with, even when I had children, you know, we. Got 20-year-old now, but at the time he was when I started doing a bit more telly. He was very young, you know. And I remember going to the London Aquarium with him, and for the first time, quite a bit of recognition.
Yeah,
and me handling it by saying instead of just going because Daddy's on the telly, I said this weird thing where I said to him, "I look like." A very famous fish person, an expert in fish, and that person thought I was that person.
Right.
A bit of a lie.
Right.
Other than, oh yeah, I'm on a telly show and they've recognised me on a telly show. I pretended it's because they thought I was somebody who was a famous.
And this is something he shares with his therapist now.
Exactly. You know what? You look like a famous fish. Yeah, some sort of expert in fish, and he thought I was them. And I remember after saying to my missus, what did I just say? I'm on the telly. Because he didn't know. He didn't watch my stuff. I don't even remember what it was now, but I wasn't used to it, put it that way.
I mean, it's funny enough, I remember being in Liverpool with Lenny Henry, and we were in a pub,
I don't know whether we were doing anything together. And this was quite early because Lenny had, because Lenny was.
Well, he was from the old school as well.
He was old school, but also people thought he was their mate. Nobody thought I was their mate.
Right.
So okay. That was a big. So people were like really close to him and really touching him, yeah. Really in a very intimate way. And I thought, this is horrible.
Because you were hilarious and scary.
Yeah, exactly.
He was hilarious and cuddling.
Yeah.
You know, that was the difference.
Yeah.
And I suppose they thought, better not mess with him, but
exactly,
it was a good couple.
Yeah. And it was
really... there's a reason you're not advertising Premier Inns, anyway.
Yeah.
I want to be a warm bed, like Lenny Henry sleeps at home. It's fully, maybe it's just accents, you know, he's got a brummy accent.
No, it's his material and his personality. You know, nobody's going to be, well, I want to be in a Premier Inn and being screamed at about genocide. They're not going to say.
It's not good for the brand, is it?
It's not good for... We want a piece of that.
They're all about the low lighting and the warmth.
Yeah. Although I did do voiceovers for many years, but we won't get into that. But
it's so that's that thing, isn't it? Of you do what you find funny, and you don't know who's going to.
Yeah,
it's just that bit in other people's hands, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I didn't. I very much valued that I wasn't him. Really, it seemed.
Well, it's interesting when you say the voiceovers, right? And
yeah,
what you definitely didn't do. I assume was I better change my act a bit so I can start getting voiceovers. No. It's just that for whatever reason, society changed, and they went, "That's been good. That's the perfect thing for that brand or whatever."
Yeah, yeah.
That's out of your hands, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously, I never appeared in an advert because I thought that's where I drew the line. But yeah, I did all kinds of products and.
I'm trying to remember. I'll know.
Toasties. Wild Bean Cafe at BP Connect. Great food on the go.
Okay, yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Flashback. I don't know what toasties are, though.
They were a sock. But with a kind of a dimpled thing on the sole, so you didn't slip.
I thought you meant cheese toast.
No.
It was a kind of socks.
Yeah, the Dremel multi. Do you remember that?
It was like
a kind of drill.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah,
that was me.
Okay.
I make a lot of money, but I never, you know, I never stopped screaming about. And it never made me think once, I won't get this work if I don't stop screaming
but
about
isn't that thing about the
class difference.
The thing on the fringe or the punk or the thing becomes into the mainstream. You know, like, I always think about, I don't know, it's weird. We talked this recently about Tiz Was and Swap Shop. Now, if you ask anyone of my generation, did you prefer Tiz Was or Swap Shop? They'll all tell you Tiz Was.
Yeah.
Because it was anarchic. It was you were the crazy kid, if you like. But the viewing figures don't add up to that. The viewing figures should be that most of you were telling the truth were watching Swap Shop. Because the viewing figures were much bigger for Swap Shop than Tiz Was.
Well, Tiz Was was only going out in the Midlands initially.
Was it? I didn't know.
Because I worked with those guys.
But we like to believe that we were all part of the revolution. You were, but a lot of people think they were.
Yeah.
They weren't really. They were watching it.
Yeah.
The difference between a punk dressing up in the street and getting on stage is, well, actually, no, punks are a bit unfair. They were really on the fringes back in the 70s. But we all had to think we were a bit more anarchic than we were. But you can at least say we were because you were doing it. That suddenly bleeds into the bit where people go, we'll have a bit of that. Could you do the voiceover for Toasties? So that's not what I'd have thought they'd have thought when they watched it 79.
But that was the sort of weird thing. I mean, I've reflected on that now because I don't know whether. Because I thought of myself in a way as being just in show business, really, even though I was yelling and screaming, calling. Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, I was on stage and calling Princess Diana a cockroach. But at the same time, I just thought, well, I'm also in show business in a way where somebody like Stuart Lee, for instance, has gone, has stayed completely, you know, Stuart would never do a voiceover. Stuart has stayed. Right. I don't know whether that's the, I think in a weird sort of way, it was, and I still don't understand it to a degree myself now, I never diluted my act at all, you know. No. I always absolutely at the edge, both in terms of the language I used and the ideas I was as expressing, but I was still accepted into the kind of showbiz firmament. I was on the telly.
Yeah, that you Yeah, no.
And in the end, I got as far as I could go, and then I wouldn't. There was a kind of limit to how I accepted that would be, you know.
But it's interesting, like stuff like, I remember saying this to you last time, that, you know, there are certain comedians that are still catchphrases in our act. So something they'll do, it could be someone that you won't have even heard of, but he saw someone one night.
Yeah.
You know, we saw a comedian once, I can't remember his name, but he held up a big plastic red bus in his act. And it was clearly a piece of shit. And in a very strong Australian accent, because he was playing a tourist.
Just right.
Like, oh, I mean, look at the quality on that. Right? And it really made me
look. Yeah.
And it's still now, all these years later, a catchphrase in our act.
Right,
where
if
we're taking the piss, we'll go, look at the quality on that. Right? And likewise, your warm-up man.
Probably Chariots.
Is still... Yeah. I still laugh when I think, oh, after years of seeing it,
yeah.
You are still a catchphrase of, I'm on pins for my knees.
Yeah.
So in our house, if I drop a spoon on the floor because I've thumped it, I'll go, I'm on pins for my knees. And it just makes us laugh. It doesn't even make us laugh anymore.
Yeah.
I've said it more than you've ever said. Because I've been saying it for 30 years, almost dead.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, but when I think about that, and think about you doing that warm-up, man. It is absolutely one of the greatest pieces of comedy I've ever seen. But doing that warm-up, man, who's just not equipped to do that, is from obviously from your love or your experience of doing those shows and probably respecting those guys. And I was one of those guys for a while. And it's bloody hard. But you can't do that joke unless you've lived that experience and that truth.
No, it was from seeing them going to recordings and seeing them, you know.
You really see someone having a breakdown like that?
Yeah. It was the one who played the jockey in Heidi High, Felix.
He was...
not Felix.
I know exactly who you mean. Felix. No, I know you mean.
But anyway, I went to see
him.
I went to see a recording of Three of a Kind with Bizarre Lenny Henry, Tracy Ullman, and
Copperfield.
David Copperfield.
Not the magician,
the other one. And they had something like there was a power cut or something, like a massive power cut that went on for 45 minutes. And this, and he wasn't, you know, he was old school and he was a bit like, you know, he was not great anyway. But he had to fill for 45 minutes. I remember him saying at one point, he said to one of the members, he said, do you want to see my watch? It's a really good watch. And he was getting photos of his fucking grandchildren out and showing them around.
Did he run out of stuff?
Yeah, he'd run out of stuff after about 5 minutes.
But I did it. And this has been on Wood All Night, because it's a true story. But I was the warm-up man on a program called Pet Power. With Anthea Turner, and about they'd have a little a dog on it, could do some amusing or whatever. She was sat on the sofa with his budgie. Now, I'd already done my bit at the beginning, and they said to me, once you've done your bit, you should be all right. I only picked those gigs because I didn't have enough material.
Right.
I did my bit at the beginning, please, my Anthea, and then I'd sort of try and keep out of the way as much as possible because it was one of those shows that seemed to go all the way through. Anyway, it hadn't gone well this night. I'd been on three or four times more than I thought I needed.
Because, like, technical breakdowns.
But I was now, I've got nothing left. And I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm thinking, please don't let anything go wrong. I sneak off to my room to use the loo a lot. I put the telly on, which shows what's going on the studio floor. And they're all looking up into the rafters and all the... There's a budgie who's come on to do something and he's flown up into the rafters. And Anthony's standing up.
Yeah.
The show's not happening.
Yeah.
And I can hear people. Get the warm-up on. And I don't know what to do. So I hid in my cupboard in the dressing room.
No.
Knock on the door. I don't answer. Knock on the door. And I hear someone coming. Lee. And go back out again. And I didn't get out of the cupboard. And then eventually I wander down to the floor. And it started again, the show. And somebody goes, where were you? And I go, you mean rolling stubby the whole time? Really styled it out and just pretended I'd been stood at the maybe the wrong side of the set, just completely standing there. I was just watching all that and I'm
bastard.
No, I know. I was so scared and nervous.
Yeah.
I didn't go back home again. So I've hidden from Anthea Turner in a cupboard. But I thought, if I get sacked again, I never want to do this again anyway.
Yeah.
But I did quite a bit of warm up, not a lot, but a bit enough to know that your character is so what I would have become.
Well, it's either on the way up or on the way down, isn't it?
Of course, absolutely. And that's,
Because Mark Lamar used to do it. People don't remember him now, but very common, very combative comic. He used to do it at Joyce. He used to really like it.
Well, some people do. I think it really, God, if you can do that, you can do anything to me. You really toughen up doing it,
So anyway, how long have we been going? An hour and a half. It's fine. We might make it into a two-parter. So you're doing you've done Gas.
Well, I've done Gas. That is, but again, don't forget, all I want in my life is to be a circuit comic.
Which sort of car did you have then? Did you drive between gigs?
Girlfriend.
Oh, you had the moped.
At the moped for London.
Yeah.
But my girlfriend had been given by her dad a VW Polo. Oh, no, tell a lie. We had a Ford Fiesta. Oh, maybe that was before I was a stand-up. We spent £150 on the Ford Fiesta, I remember that. But now we have my father-in-law's Polo, the VW Polo. So that was, but because I was a driver, sometimes you get paid a bit extra.
Right.
If an out-of-town gig, if you were the driver,
right,
you get paid an extra 30, 40 quid. But you'd have to drive all the comics there and drive.
So it'd be you, Jack D.
Jack D was before.
That was here previously.
Sort of leading the circuit as I was starting it. Maybe Graham Norton did his last few gigs as I was starting to get his own chat show and stuff.
Right.
So I didn't really know them guys.
So it'd be you in the polo.
Me in the polo. Adam Bloom.
Adam Bloom
was part of that sort of world I was in.
Catherine Tate.
Catherine was more of even then, she was only dabbling a bit in stand-up when I saw her. I remember seeing her, she was in my Edinburgh show because I saw her do stand-up and she did the voice of an old woman in the act.
Right.
So she'd do it as a stand-up and then go, it's like my nan or my auntie so-and-so used to say, and then turn into this character.
Right.
And she was a good stand-up, but she was a great character. And I sort of got to know her a bit and said, she takes the piss out of me now for it. We're still good mates. But I'd like to believe that I saw in her the future of feeling. But the real truth is, I knew she was already doing a show up there, so I wouldn't have to pay for her accommodation. So I said, do you want to be in my show as well? So she was in my show doing my, so I decided, my first nightmare thing I just told you about, four people turned up and then six, and it was just the worst Edinburgh I've ever had. And I remember standing on stage going, if I ever come back to Edinburgh again, I don't want to be on my own. I want to be able to look to my left and see someone else telling them they're off so we can have a laugh about it.
Right.
It's a very lonely existence being at Edinburgh and not doing great, you know.
Do you know I started all that as well?
Edinburgh?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
Obviously, I didn't start the Edinburgh Fringe, but me and the guy called Tony Allen.
I know Tony, yeah.
Yeah, died. We were the first stand-up comedy, 1980. The Harriet Watt.
Really?
There'd never been any stand-up comedy before the Edinburgh Festival, before me and Tony.
So the Fringe was more about sort of artistic theatre?
Samuel Beckett plays.
Right, okay.
Medical students doing sketch comedy.
And I'm guessing that was in the days when the Edinburgh Festival was bigger than the Fringe.
Yes.
But the Fringe has become much bigger than the festival. So.
Yes.
Tony Allen, when I started, before I was a stand-up, I used to go in the days when there wasn't that many clubs. I'd go, get time out and find out where my nearest club was.
Right.
To go and watch. I just wanted to be a stand-up, but I didn't know how to. So I defiled everything.
Right.
And Tony was the...
Well, Tony was OG, yeah. I mean, he started Alternative Cabaret.
Yeah.
Which was also 1979. And our first gig was at the Pindle Wake. We started it, yeah.
Yeah.
But he came up with the name and... it's called the Water Rat now, but it's called the Pinder of Wakefield on Grayson Road.
Right.
That was our first gig.
Really?
In 1979, yeah.
It was on then?
Oh, God. I think it was Tony booked them. It was me, Tony, a guy called Bob Flagg, who you'd never have heard of, probably Andy Delator.
I remember that name. He was before my time, but I remember
Francis Delator's brother.
Was it?
A guy called Jim Barclay's daughter's a comic.
Oh, again, I recognise the name.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys that, don't forget, I was starting sort of 15.
Oh, this is a long time before you. Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to be honest, even Tony was not doing a lot. I remember seeing Tony, the first time I ever saw him, he did that, which I thought was very funny. I'd be lying if I said he went down a storm. I remember his last line was, "Thanks very much for reminding me why I don't do this anymore." It's really made me a bit. We would have a rent off of that. But again, he had that thing that he symbolised probably what was different between that world and the previous comedians.
He was
this ball of fire energy, just like.
And he lived the alternative. You know, he was being a squatter, he absolutely lived the alternative lifestyle.
I suppose that's the key thing, isn't it, really? Yeah. There was a lot of, I mean, even obviously I was the generation after you, but I always talk about the fact that when I was starting out doing open spots in the early 90s, you would still get the nutters, in a really good way. So you'd be on with somebody that was a bit polished. Talent.
Yeah.
Then the next act would be you just felt there was a borderline mental health issues going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there'd be another act that was, I've been doing this for 10 years and I just do it. One of them said to me, "I just do it because I need to get out of the house." And you just get these oddballs.
Yeah.
I remember one guy turned up with a bowl of porridge shouting, "I'm Jesus," and just throwing it at the audience. So proper lunacy that you just don't see anymore, because it became more polished, it became more professional. It became more, less like everything in the arts, just about, it wasn't a question of succeeding. The goal was to not fail. So it became more beige.
Right.
As long as you don't fail, you've succeeded. Yeah. So everything became a bit safer, because it became more professional. And so you wanted to get you wanted to earn the money. The guy throwing the porridge wasn't getting paid. He was never getting paid. What did he get?
Yeah.
He was not getting rebooked.
Yeah.
He was doing it for other reasons.
Yeah.
And there was pros and cons about that for me.
But as an industry matures, that's going to happen, isn't it?
Gets into it and,
I've never railed against that. So you've had your formative fails.
So I've had my little failings. I'm looking to my left and I'm going to see somebody stood next to me, whatever that means.
Right.
I meet Catherine Tate on the circuit. I go, "Do you know what? I'll do a sketch show." Because if you do sketches, then you're in a team on stage and they can still do loads of gags. It's very gag-driven, like stand-up for my type of stand-up. So that's what I'll do. So I went back to Edinburgh, following you with Catherine and a guy called Dan Antipolsky, who I'd also found out had accommodation already booked, so I wouldn't have to pay him for his accommodation either. And don't get me, TV shows failed at this point. And so I did 2 years of sketches with Catherine and Dan. And then within that sketch show, I'd have a one-liner in my head. So, for example, the one that always springs to mind is, if you're looking out the window of the telescope, and your wife walks in and suddenly you raise up to the moon. What are you looking at? Oh, nothing, just look at the moon. Just a little idea. You go, well, that's not a sketch. It's not a lights up, do it, and blackout.
Yeah.
It's just a mildly amusing moment.
Yeah.
So I had about 50 of them. So what can we do with them? I know, I'll put them all together in like a flat situation.
Right.
So it's basically the dumping ground for everything else where it doesn't fit in as a sketch, a standalone sketch. And it grew into this sort of 15-minute sketch set in a flat. And it became like the main, I suppose, the best bit of the show. And we got nominated for a Perrier Award, and it was a successful year for us. And they basically took all those sketches and turned them into a show on ITV called The Sketch Show. They imaginatively titled The Sketch Show, which you may not remember, a lot of people don't remember.
I don't know.
It was me, Tim Vine, Jim Tabaret, Ronnie Ancona, and Karen Taylor. And they basically used a lot of those sketches that I did at Edinburgh and turned them into another telly show.
Okay.
But I didn't give them that flat sketch because I thought if I do a sitcom one day, that would make a sitcom.
Right.
So I sort of shelved that. And then they spent 2 years doing this ITV sketch show, which was a good lesson in these award ceremonies because we won a BAFTA, but it's the only, until recently, it's the only BAFTA I'd ever been part of a show. It's the only BAFTA I won for being a show that I've been a part of, but it's also the only show that had been pulled mid-run the following series. It shows you the sort of nonsense of these things, you know.
Hello, we're just interrupting your fun to ask for money, basically. We need Patreon to keep this going. You're getting this for nothing, so fucking give us some money, basically, at
patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast.
Ta!
Very early on in my career, I won two awards. One was the Pi Radio Awards, when it was still made. British manufacturer radios became the Sonys later on. It was a brand of radio. And also I won some advertising award. But in both, the kind of chairman of the awards jury said, before he gave the awards, he said, well, it's been a very poor year.
We found this engraved on the reward.
Yes.
And it's just got worse.
Yeah, it's been a very poor year, but the winner of the best comedy is Alexis. Oh, no. Anyway. So they pulled this sketch show.
So we did the sketch show for 2 years on ITV.
So it was ATV, though. So what time of night was it? What time of night were you on?
We were on, I really can't remember. It was a fairly good slot.
Because did that bring you fame?
Not so 85 fame, but I put it one way. No, because the story I talked about being recognised in the aquarium was after my sitcom started. So it was after that. So not really. I mean, yes, a little bit. That sort of like they think they know you, but they don't know where they're from. But not what I would call.
I just have the feeling I saw you on the telly, and I don't know where really.
It was
just
the late 90s.
Yeah,
it was the gas show. Sketch show was like 2000, 2001, and then
I mean, I was on the odd panel.
Gow was on They Think It's All Over once, and then I was the host of They Think It's All Over in its final year when Nick Hancock left. I took over for the final.
Right,
me and Boris Becker were brought on to rebrand it a bit. That lasted a year. No one remembers being on that.
No,
he was much better than me. I didn't Nick. I mean, they should have kept with him. I really think that, but they gave me a bash at it. But it's like the last sort of rights for, come on, give them, what's the word when they give you the electric shock and see it work.
Yeah.
So I did that. I was appearing on things, and probably because you're into comedy, you might have seen
it,
whereas the average person in the street wouldn't have necessarily recognised me. I certainly didn't go out with a hat and glasses on in those days. It wasn't that kind of thing. Around about the same time, two shows happened that are now still on, which was Would I Lie To You started in, first of all, it was my sitcom Not Going Out.
So tell me about that.
Well, so that was, again... I mean,
that's been going how long?
Oh, like 2006, but I wrote the pilot in 2005.
So it's really interesting to see it because it's on reruns and...
Well, you see it, and it's
really evolved, hasn't it? It's really interesting, in a way.
The evolving has been forced because a lot of the casts have left.
Right.
So Miranda Hart was in it for a while. Tim Vine is a very good mate of mine still. Yeah. He was in it. We've had so many casts over the years come and go. But we also jumped ahead in it 7 years, and now we're married with kids. We were just flatmates in it.
Yeah.
So it has evolved in that sense. So basically I was asked to do this. Saw the sketch show, I think, and just gave a sort of small, in the way that they give out lots of script commissions, it's a small, relatively small investment for them.
Just to make a pilot. This was the BBC directly, was it?
Well, it was BBC Two specifically.
Yeah.
Was it BBC generally? I know the pilot was made for BBC Two.
It was the producer.
Back then, it was Charlie Hanson.
All right.
Do you know Charlie?
I know the name.
Was the producer, but we're sort of jumping ahead, like, because at that time it's just here's a bit of money to make. It wasn't like a big. I keep going back to this thing that is genuinely true. I just wanted to be at the time a circuit comic. I never achieved that, and I was very happy. I was earning good money, but I wasn't also not completely disinterested in telling that if someone comes along then.
Right.
I mean, I was doing a sketch show at Edinburgh. I must have had one eye perhaps on making a TV show. But if I'm going to be honest also, it'd be quite nice to do well at Edinburgh because I'd had a bit of a failing with the Mighty Boosh doing well and me doing my stand-up show that wasn't so good. It'd be nice to do something that was better and be sort of more well-received like they were perhaps, you know. You have master plans all the time. You just sort of do these things. And wouldn't it be good to do a good show at Edinburgh at full stop, you know? Then they see that and they give you a little bit of money to try things and try. Then did the script for Not Going Out.
You wrote that by yourself?
At the time, I wrote that with Hitchhiker episode. So I think the pilot was with Andrew Collins, who's a writer.
Yeah.
And there's bits of TV stuff. And I remember at the time thinking, I think I'm pretty confident in my joke writing abilities, but I've never written a story or a script. Where do I start with that? And I had this theory that I think it was Avalon, who were my management then and still are, we were a TV company as well. And they said, well, we'll put you together with somebody else. And they said, we've got this guy called Andrew who has written for EastEnders. And I remember thinking, well, EastEnders is half an hour.
Yeah.
Surely sitcom is drama plus jokes, isn't it? If he does the drama and I do the joke, we're laughing, right? But I very quickly learned that it's a unique genre of sitcom. It's not drama plus jokes. It's just the only people that can write sitcoms are people who've written sitcoms.
Yeah.
And that's quite a hard thing because where do you find those people? I certainly wasn't one of them.
No.
But I think we did a good enough effort to get the pilot.
Yeah.
You made the pilot. And I remember thinking, look, if it doesn't happen after the pilot, at least I'll have, you know what it's like. You take an idea to a TV person, they read it and they go, I don't think this is right. And they go, it's because you're not seeing it like I'm seeing it. I can make it and they can see it. And then they don't want it. I'll be fine because there's no excuses there. I've done it, you know. So I made it thinking it probably wouldn't get made. And then they said, yeah, we'll have a series. So that was like, wow.
And this is a rarity now, isn't it? So it's a multi-camera. Yeah, well, no, that's also true.
That'd be hard to get it now.
But it's filmed in front of a live studio audience.
Live studio audience.
And it's multi-camera.
Multi-proper cameras. Studio, four or five cameras, all live edited. You know, there's a vision mix that mixes it for the audience. And to me, I was no way trying to be. Although at the time there was studio sitcoms on, there was a fair few, but not many. There was My Family, there was I think Goodnight Sweetheart with Nick Lyndhurst, but they were still being made. It wasn't that unusual to see a studio sitcom. No. So, but there was a general consensus that they were on the way out.
Right, waitress.
And I've told this story before, but it is true that the night before I made the pilot. There was a documentary on ITV called The Sitcom Is Dead. And it's all about the idea that The Office and the Royal Family, the TV show The Royal Family, had now changed the way television was going to be made. And Victoria Wood herself, who was very big with dinner ladies at the time, is basically on screen saying, forget it. My type of comedy now, certainly studio sitcom, is gone. It won't happen anymore because of this. And I was watching and going, why did anybody tell me this? I didn't know this. I thought I knew it was not as popular, but everyone in the industry seemed to be saying how it was over. And they were talking about shows I loved The Office, I loved The Royal Family.
Yeah.
But I also
For those listening who don't know, they're single camera.
They're single
shot
camera.
Like a movie, as it were.
Yeah, so there's no audience.
There's no audience.
And it was the start of a sort of, in the way that you guys, if alternative comedy sort of revolutionized stand-up and indeed comedy in general, these guys were sort of, they weren't the first to do it by any means, but this idea of the mockumentary style, literally a mockumentary of The Office, and that they were pretending to make a documentary. And in The Royal Family, although it wasn't a mockumentary, it had a mockumentary vibe. The shaky camera. You put the camera in someone's face and it just wobbles a bit to make you feel like it's real. Like it's a real documentary style where this is happening for real right now, you know. And that just became the only way to make comedy. So it was perceived. And I remember thinking, why is it that everyone's telling me that this is the only way to make comedy? But when you see a list of the all-time greatest, or you ask people, what's your favourite sitcom?
Yeah.
people always will mention Seinfeld and Frasier. They always seem to be up there, top two. Everyone loves Raymond, was still huge in America. Yeah. These are all traditionally filmed studio-based sitcoms. And I realised what they meant was British sitcoms in studios are not working.
Right.
The American ones are still...
Big Bang Theories.
Exactly. The obvious thing, I thought, just watch a million American sitcoms and work out what they're getting right.
Right.
We appear to be getting wrong.
Very clever.
Not that I'm saying they're getting wrong, but this is what everyone's telling me.
Yeah.
What is the difference between the two things? And I sat there like a little academic kid with a pen and paper.
That's very clever,
And started spotting things. For example, the gag rate. Gag rate in America, in Britain, they come in the door and go, hi, how's your day been? In America, they come through the door and go, hi, how's your day been? Followed by a laugh.
Right.
How can we make hi, how's your day been funny? There's not an ounce of fat on anything they said.
No.
The attempt to get the laugh. And if you put a tick.
I mean, one of the reasons for that was in the States that was written, because those shows were written by a writer's room of 12,
absolutely,
15.
It was because of that.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think, institutionalised as well.
Right.
But that might have been the original reason.
Yeah.
But we just accept things the way they are. Like, they accept things the way they are, and they say, no, it's fine to come in and say, how are you? I'm fine. Do you want a cup of tea? Yeah, I'll make you one. And then a joke.
Right.
Yeah, well, what was all that about? Oh, that's just a bit of waffle. Well, I'll do the waffle then.
Right.
Because everything, you're getting less laughs per minute.
Right.
And if you've got an audience, what's the point of having an audience? If the aim of the show is to make people laugh, just make them laugh as many times as you can. If the aim of the show is to make them laugh and be a bit sad and dramatic, fine. But I'm watching British sitcoms where that's not your aim. Right. Your aim is to just make them laugh, but you're happy with what they call the joker page.
Yeah.
You used to always say, got to be a joke on every page. A joke on every page just isn't enough when you watch an American sitcom. It's going to be about six jokes on a page or ten, you know. And I spotted other things. I was spotting the way they film it was much wider shots. So you'd see, like, Kelsey Grammer and Frasier would stand there for ages in a big full body shot, and the camera wouldn't be cutting around. And that made me think, I wonder if that's because, even if it's subconsciously, it makes you feel like you're in a theatre watching it.
Right.
If you're in a theatre, it justifies hearing people laughing. Because when you see a comedy play, no one cares that.
Right.
People around you laughing is part of the enjoyment of watching a comedy play. But on telly, everyone's getting angry about the laughs. We don't need to laugh. Why is that? Well, that's because it's intrusive, because it's being filmed close in.
Right.
And now it's two things going on at once.
Right.
Maybe the Americans are doing it deliberate to make you feel like that's what you'd be seeing. In a seat, you'd be looking up and seeing a full body, big wide shots, and wrote that down.
Right.
So trying to do all these little things and trying to see what it was we were trying to emulate, I suppose. And, you know, and the first few series were quite American in terms of, listen, some people hate my sitcom, but the ratio of gags was there.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't.
And what was the sitcom? I mean, it's a great title, Not Going Out.
Well, that was if I'm going to be honest, that was only ever there really because we did a live version of it in a theatre before it ever became a pilot, just to front of 50 people.
That's also very clever,
Try the material out, you would be sad. You'd never go on a TV stand-up show with brand new material. You said yourself, in the young ones, you were doing stuff you'd done before.
Absolutely.
Because you knew it worked.
Yeah, yeah.
Why would people go on a sitcom that's gags and untested? I didn't get why that would be.
That's
I've just done the sketch show for 2 years, the one I told you about. That I insisted that was in front of an audience first.
Right.
Just test it out like you would.
Yeah.
Or you put it in front of millions, put it in front of.
Oh, that's what I do with my radio series sandwich.
Just nonsense, right? Yeah, yeah. But you're probably a rarity doing that with your radio show. Some people just go, I'll just try it out.
They do that? Particularly, and it's fucking awful.
It's insane. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's insane. Yeah. You get two chances, not one. Or feature, you tweak it.
Yeah.
I've never understood that.
No, well, it is. Yeah, I think you're right. It's a cultural thing as well. It's a lack of seriousness.
It's the way they've all, the amount of times I hear the phrase, that's just the way it's done.
Yeah.
Whenever they say it, it's telling you, that's the way it's been done. That's the way it's always been done. I would say, yeah, but do you not agree that most telly isn't good enough? That's what I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it might sound awful, but I do think that most jokes I write aren't good enough. I know that. I write 20 jokes. I try them out. I used to try them out every Monday night at my local club. And if one of them made it to the tour, I'd be happy. So what it means is most of my jokes aren't good enough. I accept that. So I'm happy to say most telly's not good enough, or most of anything in the arts isn't good enough. Try and dilute it down to the bits that work.
Absolutely, yeah.
Why would you do that kind of waffle? you know.
Yeah.
And but anyway, so we did.
And what was the sit itself?
So the sit was, so me and in the live version before we got, before we tried it, when we tried it out, was that I was married to, or I was going out with Catherine Taylor. She was my girlfriend. I had a mate. It wasn't a great situation, but there was enough of it that I was the slacker and needed to get my life sorted out. And she was the, you know, she was a more professional person than me. But we just couldn't get our relationship to work, I felt. So I thought, rather than get that to work, let's just change the title to not going out with each other.
Right.
Not change the title, but let's say we're not going out with each other.
Yeah, right.
And if we're not going out, then at least we can forget that problem.
Right.
And I think it was Andrew Collins that said that. I think he said, why don't we just call it Not Going Out, or why don't is it the name of a song or something? I can't remember. But it was very casually said. It was like a little post-it note. We'll call it that for now. And it just stuck. So in the pilot, Catherine's in the pilot as my flatmate, who I fancy, but nothing's happened. So if people go, there's no chemistry, fine, we're not going out with each other.
Right.
It was a cheat, really, you know.
Yeah.
And then she became very successful and didn't want to do the series, which completely, I can understand now, 18 years later. But at the time, I went, fucking hell, Catherine. But we always remained good mates, and I just, then we got another person in for the series, and that was the start of the sitcom. 2006, I think, yes. For a fest, so.
So you're on series what now?
Just about, we're just writing, I was doing it this morning, actually, series 14.
Wow.
We've had some years off, so that's why it's not, the maths don't add up.
Yeah.
We've been cancelled as well after series 3.
But then a lot, by the BBC.
Yeah, the BBC cancelled it after 3 series. And that is why I always remember the story about the aquarium, because that was on series 3.
Right.
When I remember going, because it wasn't just that one incident. That day at the aquarium, there was a different level of recognition.
Right.
And I suddenly thought, my sitcom is sort of working. People are liking the show. I'm not used to being recognised.
Right.
And it was the same series that it got cancelled. And whilst it was on telly, we were recording the next one, I think. I think it was, I can't remember the order, but after about series 3. It was on telly as we were making it.
Right.
Or something like that. But the bottom line is, during the recording of it, I got a lift home from my manager. And he went, just so you know, I just wanted to tell you, this is it. We can cancel that. And I went, but I was just in an aquarium and it's working.
Yeah.
So I'm debtless.
Yeah.
I've had to pretend I'm an expert. Yeah. I look like an expert in fish because I didn't like the recognition. Why cancel it now? I understand the first 2 being cancelled.
Yeah.
And then, I wasn't very internet savvy, but I remember the only time I met Graham Linderham, actually. We did a radio show together, and I gave him a lift, and he's very on the ball with stuff like that online.
Yes.
Very online. But this was in the days even pre-Twitter or anything. Right. I remember him saying to me, the reason we got our show back was because there'd been a petition online.
Really?
It had a bit of traction.
Right.
He said, and he says, you were one of the first, or something like, he said something like, you're the first time that they'd, a comedy show had gained enough interest online that had been, that they wanted to bring back, that the power of the people worked a bit. Now, that might not be true, I don't know, but I remember thinking, God, it's quite powerful, this internet thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
But from nowadays, you get asked to sign something every day, don't you? If you sign this position.
Yeah, yeah. Well.
It was pre social media, I suppose you could say.
So somebody organised a petition. I mean, just the way that a kind of petition got going.
I just think some of the people that like watching it also got the thing going. Did anyone connect with our show? Do it? I definitely didn't, because I didn't have any. God, I haven't got any social media now. I certainly didn't have that then.
No. And the BBC actually caved to that, or they.
Well, yeah, I don't know if they caved or.
No, maybe that's the wrong.
I don't know what the
phrase.
You might be right. I like to think they did tell you.
Yeah.
Show that people loved it. You know. I do honestly think perhaps that the reason it got cancelled and the reason it got brought back was the same thing. Just a bit knee jerky.
Yeah.
Some dinner party, maybe someone's gone, not a big fan of that show. Oh, you better get rid of that. And then
yeah. A few weeks later, those things did happen.
Oh, I missed that show. Oh, do you? I better bring it. I've realised that even though we criticise the Americans for the, you know, they have those dials when they make them sit in a room testing.
Yeah.
And if they like it, they turn the dial up. And if they don't, they turn it up. And we sort of mock that as not being very artistic. But I tell you what, sometimes the opposite is worse, where one person's decision in a room or a few people can decide so much when perhaps a little bit of a vote, shall we say, a little bit of the people be asking, basically viewing figures, go with, you know, I personally feel that at the time we were brought back, Last of the Summer Wine was cancelled.
Right.
Now, it was cancelled because the viewing figures were going down, but I think it ended on like 6 million viewing figures.
Jesus, you know, that's gigantic.
You know, I might be wrong about it. But, and of course, you've got to factor in it was viewing figures were generally different back in 20 years ago. But, well, 15 years ago. It just probably wasn't cool enough. That's probably the real truth. It wasn't seen as the future. You've got some very old men going down the hill in a bath. How much longer can they do this
for? Yeah.
So they're going, well, let's bring in some new people to the show and keep it going. But I just think it's...
Well, I'm sure you're right, yeah.
It all felt a bit like classism to me.
Yeah, well, there's like, that as well, you know,
These people are, they're not spent... I know it's not a commercial channel, but it's almost like the non-commercial channels are sometimes trying to keep one eye on the demographics as well. And the demographics of a generally older population watching a programme perhaps has less value to them.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that obsession with youth is... I mean, because young people, they're going to get old.
They're going to get old.
You fucking idiots.
It's
you,
Ned.
Yeah.
It's like that Jerry Seinfeld line, isn't it? Going, I've had a baby and everybody loves my baby. I want to see photographs of the baby. I'm showing my baby to everybody. They all want to see it, but let's not forget why the baby's here. The baby is here to... It's true, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
You sometimes forget that. Yeah. You know that they will go, and then one day they'll have a baby, and their baby will replace that. And that's what happens in telly. You know,
and don't moan about it. I always say.
Yeah.
So, you're on series 14, 15.
So series 14.
It's on BBC One.
BBC One, and so we've been doing it. Started in my 30s and now mid 50s, so
I suppose in an increasingly commercial age, it must be a bit odd now being a big hit on the BBC, really. What's that feel like?
Well, it's, if I'm going to be honest, like everything I do, I don't really feel it's a big hit. I just know it's been on a long time.
But it wouldn't be honest,
you know, in the industry we work in and the people we see at work at our job, they don't watch studio sitcoms any more than they watch EastEnders or Coronation Street. You know, these shows that some of the biggest shows aren't watched by our industry.
No.
That's what I find.
Yeah.
And so I'm not saying we're one of the biggest shows, but we certainly get decent viewing figures. If I'm going to be honest, in the 30, gosh, how long have I been in this now? So 20 odd years in telly. The only show I've ever felt feels like, my God, this is actually a bit of a, or certainly an overnight hit, is the quiz show I do at the moment, where it's ITV
The One. Oh, fuck, you've got a daytime quiz. Is it a daytime quiz show?
It's a Saturday night show.
Saturday night show. I'm sorry.
But that was sort of instant. Everything else I've been on seems to have taken years, you know.
Right.
But that was sort of landed somehow instantly as a show that, you know, you only go by what people say to you in the street.
Yeah.
I love what I like, and then suddenly that becomes, I love watching the 1% Club, I love the show, and I suddenly thought, I'm not used to that instant thing. It's not going out. It took years before anyone could even remember the name of it. And even now, after, you know, Would I Lie to You has been hugely successful for the people that make it, for us, and the BBC, but it took quite a few years before people stopped saying, oh, I quite like the show about the truths, and they don't remember the name of it, you know. So I wasn't used to that instant recognition of a show, perhaps, or the 1% Club.
Right.
But yeah, you know, it's...
So do you go out live as well, then? Do you do live stand-up?
Well, I haven't... I used to do a lot, I used to try and tour and check up, but I haven't actually done a proper stand-up tour for about 7 or 8 years now.
Right.
And it bugs me a bit, because, I don't know, when you reach your mid-50s, you start going, am I ever going to go back on the road? And it is... what I started doing. I was a stand-up. You know, all I wanted to do was be a stand-up on the circuit.
Well, I mean, what size venues were you playing when you landed 7 years ago?
Well, I would do, got the Bridge. You know, I'd start off in the art centres to build up material.
Yeah,
I suppose the big ones were like the 3,000s and stuff like that. But it was at a time when, or still is, you know, a lot of comedians chose to do the arenas.
I could never, I mean, I know that might make me sound, I mean, there is a limit. I can't stand by you. Well, I can understand why you would do that, because you make a fuck ton of money. But I, as a comic, I think that's...
For me, it was...
Beyond the pale.
I talk a lot to the audience, certainly at the end of the show.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't ever get my head around how you would talk to an audience in an arena. And so, personally, I chose to do, you know, a few nights in a you know, reasonably big theatre rather than trying to do arena, because then...
You still make it. You're paying like...
I don't think the economics are much different. If you do, you just do a lot more nights. That's the difference. So you're away from home more. Now, I can't lie, as I've got older, even though would it be as good, some family life's more important, but...
Yeah.
So I don't know if I've got another 130 dates in me. No, I did try it one night. I said, I'll do one night in an arena and test it, see what it feels like.
All right.
I've pushed it already in the city. I've done quite a few nights in the city. So to try and sell another 15,000 in one night of an arena was pushing it. But we still maybe half filled it or something.
Right.
Got 6,000 or 7,000.
This was a show that you sort of well worked. So you weren't doing your
banging out every night sometimes. Yeah. And Matt Annie as well, if I go up to Glasgow and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think the only way for me to consider it is to try and bring in a camera. So you talk to someone in the front row, the camera's on them, and you actually get them up and see them. It's even more intimate. See, this is what I did find, if I'm going to be honest. You play 1,000 seat or 1,500, it's quite intimate in the, what you call the proscenium.
Yeah.
You know, with the little boxes and all that.
Yeah.
You go up to about 3,000, like the Hammersmith Apollo, whatever it's called now, the Eventing Apollo.
Yeah.
And it's sort of too big for stand-up to talk to the audience. You go a bit bigger to an arena and put the screens up.
Right.
It becomes a bit more intimate again because your face is on a big screen.
Right.
You can't justify a big screen in the Hammersmith Apollo, but you have to have one in an arena.
Right.
Now, obviously, it's nowhere near as intimate as that 1,500 seat.
No, I mean, the biggest I've played would be like Liverpool Empire, which I think is around about 3,000.
But that's an intimate.
It's intimate. It's a good...
I don't know, the way it's shaped or something.
Yeah, like Edinburgh Playhouse is the same. It's 3,000.
Doable, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
But it's something, you can get 2,000 or 1,500. It isn't.
Yeah.
It suddenly feels massive.
Yeah.
You know, I love the names they give them, like the St. Albans Arena. You played that?
No.
I think that'd be the first time it is pushing in the word arena. You've got to slap the word arena on the end of anything, you know. But there are some that... It's not always about the size, but it's a good rule of thumb, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that it becomes just too big, you know?
Yeah.
But it's fair to say that some acts do suit. And I'm tempted if I did it again, because I'm not sure if I've got 159 in there.
That's an awful... I mean, I've never done a tour of more than about 30 dates.
That's probably the way to do it, isn't it?
But
I might be exaggerating. I'm also counting those little warm-up gigs in clubs and stuff.
Yeah.
But actually, proper dates, I've definitely done 100. And every 7 years is enough for me, I think. It's like being home.
Yeah.
It's not a greenhouse, I love it. Isn't it a greenhouse? And you get a statistic, and you've had it, you're not going on the road again.
You don't think you ever will? No. You go on the...
I've did it.
And you do a live show of... You're not allowed... You do a live show with...
I would have liked it.
You're not cooked.
Legal reasons, I should change that sentence.
David Mitchell and Rob...
I love your show. I haven't got an edit.
Yeah.
We do a live show with me, David and Rob from Would I Lie To You.
Yeah.
And then the original idea was, wouldn't it be great to tour Would I Lie To You? I had the idea because my auntie, I'll rephrase that, someone I know, said to me, I saw the greatest show ever, greatest comedy show I've ever seen. I went, oh yeah, what was that? She said, Question of Sport on the live tour. She's a slightly elderly lady.
Yeah.
Question of Sport's been on for years. It's great.
Yeah.
But I did say to David and Rob, surely we can do at least as well as Matt Dawson and Phil Tufnell on the live tour.
You'd like to think so. You know, they're sports,
we are professional comedians. We should be able to do at least as well.
Yeah.
Even push our luck and say maybe even better. Who knows? So why don't we tour? We'd allow to. So we perform to 400 people a night for 3 hours. I think I said it's
3 hours.
It's a good 2.5, 3 hours.
Oh, in the TV show.
In the TV show.
Yeah.
we tour it, you know. But then we found that it was easier to just... I don't think there was at first the will from other people involved to perhaps tour it. So a lot of our work to go up with all these research for truths and lies and stuff. So why don't we just create something? So we just created a different thing. So that I liked performing as a tour. But again, like you just said, maybe 20, 30 dates we did. And also going back to what I said before, I can look to my left and there's someone on stage.
Yeah.
I always like the camaraderie. Of
that. Yeah.
I think it perhaps goes back to the days of having a proper job. Quite like the canteen. You know what I mean? I quite like the coffee breaks.
Yeah.
That's what I like about the sitcom. It's a 9-to-5 job. Going at 10 in the morning, like 9 or 10, come home at 5, Monday to Thursday, and then Friday go to the studio and record it in front of an audience. There's a feeling of a normal job.
Right.
Sounds awful to say I miss clocking in, but you know the clocking in days?
Yes.
Get your mates, can you clock me in? I'm late. All that.
That was usually me.
Regularity that you perhaps don't get as a stand-up on the circuit. You've got weird hours as a stand-up. You're all over your shot. One day you're in Aberdeen, the next week you're in Dorking, 20 minutes from your house. It's so weird. What about you? Are you touring here?
No, well, I was two-thirds of the way through a kind of comeback tour in 2020 when COVID struck, and I haven't...
You didn't go back and do the remaining dates, though?
No, I cancelled them in the end. I didn't feel up
to it. When's the comeback tour? How long would the gap be?
17 years.
That's it? Yeah. How was that? What was that feel like to have that time off and go back?
It was fantastic, really. That wasn't that tour.
You did have a little warm-ups first. You did just straight out?
No, the way it worked, I stopped doing stand-up in 1996 in Perth, Western Australia, was my last stand-up gig as that guy in the tight suit.
Right.
And I realised that guy.
That went, did it?
I'd come to the end of all that. And then I saw myself as a writer for like the next 20 years. But what I did was book readings and stuff, and I'd do a Q&A, and I would talk about my own life.
Being interviewed or just you on stage?
Just me on stage. Sometimes interviewed.
So it's not stand-up as such, but it's still a version.
It's a live thing, And from that came, I would start to talk about my own life, really, which I could never do as the guy in the suit, really, that's because he was a character. So and then in 2011, Stuart Lee asked me to do a sort of weird show he was curating at the Queen Elizabeth Hall. And I just took all these bits I've been doing in the Q&A at the book readings and made it into stand-up. And that made me think, fuck, I can do stand-up, but in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Completely different.
Because you were bored with that version. I was
more than bored. I was very unhappy with it. I was really extremely unhappy with that old version. I just started doing it again, really. Yeah. So 2011, and then I did Edinburgh in 2013 and did a, like, 12-week run at the Soho Theatre. And then the stand-up tour was 2020. Yeah, I'd just done 5 nights at Liverpool, and then COVID struck.
So now COVID's over.
I'm 71 now. So, I mean, it's physically...
You want to go back to the tight suit manager? Yeah. I want to see the tight suit man live. Do for me and my missus.
I don't know what he would be like now. I don't know. I can't. I mean, we had a big comeback tour booked in with the McIntyres, like playing the 2,000 seats. And I just couldn't face it, really. I'd worked the material live. It was fucking killing.
Right.
And I just thought, it's not there anymore.
I'm 55, and I struggle a bit to be away from home, to be on the road. I don't know. For me, stand-up's a bit, what's the phrase? I don't know. It's seen as the purest form of comedy, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I think comedians are quite snobby about it, including myself. You know, I think because you spend your life being told it's the hardest thing you can ever do. You're so brave. I think you can start believing it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's sort of Jesus life. When in fact, I remember Ivan Dunbeer, is that Ivan?
Yeah.
He'd say to me one day, the greatest secret that only comedians know It's just how easy it is to entertain people for 20 minutes. But I'm sure you
And you have to have the gift.
Of course
you do. But if you've got that, if that's what you can do, that's what
you can do. It's absolutely true that it's not as easy as he meant. And he's only joking with himself.
Yeah.
But on a barometer of that to Jesus-like, it's closer to the easier than people know than it is to being Jesus.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people do start believing them. And I say people, I mean me, you know, perhaps I've started to be, oh my God, this is the hardest thing in the world to do, so I must concentrate on this because this is such a unique gift to be able to do. But actually, it's not that, to me, why I personally got involved in it. It was like I said before, having a laugh with my mate. What's the nearest thing to having a laugh with your mates? What it isn't is standing up and being the only one around the table that's talking as they're all listening.
Yeah.
If it was, then great, I'll try and recreate that and become a stand-up comedian. But it's the interaction, you know, the chat, and that. What's the nearest I can get to creating that? I dig back in. I hosted the Royal Writers Show a couple of years ago. I thought, I can't go on there rusty. So I better start going back to the clubs again. And I went back to the clubs and thinking it would be re-energising. Oh, God, I've missed this. And I sort of didn't. I sort of liked it, but not enough to go up to Scotland for a week and miss my family. That sort of, you know.
Yeah.
It's like being at home. I like watching Match of the Day.
Do you think, I mean, what is your, just to wrap up, really, where now for you? What is?
Well, I've got things sort of contracted in for the first time in years where I know what I'm doing for a couple of years, you know, so I know that the quiz show's happening, I know my sitcom is happening in the future, and Would I Lie to You is happening for at least another couple of series. So for the next couple of years, I'm happy with that, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I always think when it all stops, I'll get back into the stand-up, you know.
I mean, we've only met a couple of times. I mean, your character, your nature comes through in your comedy, I think, doesn't it? That, you know, there's not that raving Russell Brand like insanity in you.
There isn't. Yeah, no, it's fair to say that I've always felt that, you know, that, you know, some people have said it's better than sex. They'll say that about anything. If you're a footballer, scoring a goal is better than sex.
Yeah.
If you're a comedian, getting the laugh is better than sex.
Yeah.
And I've heard people talk about it. Nothing is, when you do that joke and everyone's like, nothing in the world will beat that feeling. And I've always felt like, am I doing it wrong then? Because I like it. I think it's great. But it's not so good that it consumes me. It's what I love is the challenge of writing a joke. I think that's really hard, to write something that's funny. Or even say something funny, conversationally, you know. It's quite hard sometimes. And so to be able to think of something on your computer that you go out that night and try it out, and it works, nothing beats that. To the point where, in fact, I think I heard Diane Morgan on your show, on this, say the same thing. I was listening to thinking, that's what I'm like.
Right.
When you go, once I've proven that it worked, I've done it. I've done the challenge now. The hard bit's been done, all the excitement has been done. To say it another 50 times, and I remember now, it's all coming back to me. You said to Diane, I don't get that. If it works, you keep doing it.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, I'm like her. I don't get you.
Yeah, when she's like you in a sense.
Once I've done the challenge of does this work, that's for me is the joy. The writing, the creative side, rather than the performing side, is probably more slightly tops it. I see myself as more of a writer than a performer, I suppose, if that's the right word. I don't know. I would have liked to use performing, so I see that as more like being with my mates in the book.
Well, yeah, it certainly has that vibe.
I love this job. Best job I've ever had. Of course it is. It's anyone that's paid more than 100 quid a week. But it's not everything, is it? It's not, you know.
I think you're very rare saying that.
Well, you know, but maybe I'm deluded and it's more consuming than I think it is. I don't know. Maybe my wife's going to listen to this and go, what the fuck? I know in the house who's going, is this funny? If I said, you know. But to be fair, I don't do that.
Yeah.
I used to read my scripts to her.
Yeah.
Is this any good? But no, it's all, you know, well, listen, we've got three kids and two cats and two dogs and loads of goldfish. And we just don't have a minute. You know, we just, the house is full of life and things to do. We've got three teenagers who need sorting out.
Right. You know, I hate you.
So
I hate your happiness.
I'm not happy.
No.
I think you've got to remember that when you say you hate my happiness, it's a bit like when people say to me, you're one of the hardest working comedians, and I think that says more about comedians than it does about. I think you telling me I'm happy says a lot more about all the other comics.
Right.
I think there's a disproportionate amount of in all of the arts.
Dysfunction, yes.
But when you're stood there on your own doing it, it's. I mean, being an actor can turn you into a nightmare, but being a stand-up can turn you into a much bigger nightmare.
Absolutely,
because you are getting all the glory, and all the stress, and all the failings.
Yeah.
It's all on you.
And I must say, I mean, it was the happiest. I mean, I think when I was talking about the guy in the suit, it's because I had a lot of that, what you're talking about, insanity. And what was wonderful about
Gus. You're referring to the guy in the suit like it is.
Yeah, he's not me. Some other, it's a demon. Well, yeah.
It's interesting because I had a phrase I was quite proud of in the autobiography that fits that, which was the difference between actors and comedian type line is that actors pretend to be someone else.
Yeah.
Go on stage and pretend to be someone else, but comedians on stage are pretending to be themselves.
Yes,
they're not being themselves, they're pretending to be themselves. And that's the fundamental difference.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect example. Because I would have, until you just said that, if you'd have said to me, it's just an extension of me and that's just me. But the fact that you're referring to him as somebody else.
Aspects of me. But I think it was also, I had that thing where I had to be, and what I loved about going back to it in like 2011, 2012 was that, you know, in the 90s, I had to be, if I did a benefit, I had to be the funniest. I had to smash
that's
it. Everybody else had to be destroyed, you know. I had to be the funniest, you know. And somewhere in the intervening those 17 years, I lost that. And I was so glad that I'd lost it.
Because I'll tell you what it's worth. You were the funniest.
Well, that's also true.
It might have got a price, but,
I
know. I mean, look, like everybody in the school playground, we loved Rick and we were doing impressions, didn't we? But you coming on, did something change when you came on where it felt like it's almost like you were in a different show when you came on? Well, you literally were because you were doing stand up and talking down the bed sometimes, but you were also the landlord, so you were doing a bit of everything. But that series of stuff for me is as good as anything I've said on TV, genuinely.
Yeah. Really, I don't know why it doesn't get repeated, really. It's just
not that era of comedy. Because I suppose, you know, people say to me it's a bit of what you do is a bit old school and a bit modern or whatever.
Yeah.
But in a way, that was sort of, there were sketches, there was a bit of stand up, there was a bit of variety.
Variety often singing, associated with, dancing, you know,
a bit of everything.
Right? Yeah.
Which is. Just, you don't really see as much of that on TV anymore. It's very, everything's very other thing now.
Yeah. It pisses me off a bit that it's not.
Why is it repeated?
It's something, I don't know. It's either because I'm so fantastic that people were acknowledging, you know, I'm such a problem. I'm such a threat.
But you can't, if you're a problem and a threat, you've made it now. They don't even have to deal with you. They just press play.
Yeah, I kind of. I might be a licensing. I don't know why it's not.
Is it out? Is it on your YouTube channel?
Some people have pirated it. It's on YouTube.
But who made it? Who's got the rights?
BBC.
Is it in house?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a problem.
Bond it on your YouTube channel so if you watch it again.
Yeah. All right.
Great. Just stuff, like gold and stuff. There's so many places to repeat stuff.
Yeah, I know.
You know what I think? I think it's what the classic, when you don't know the answer to something in this mental world of television, it's often just because someone will listen to this and go, oh yeah, we should pull that off. Sometimes they just don't think, do they?
No.
And we all think this for other reasons.
Partly because I don't sort of fit in a way to any established narrative. I think that the business has a slight problem without it categorise me. And so my stuff gets a bit ignored because of that, really. Because you can't say I'm this, you can't say I'm that. I'm this kind of hybrid of the, you know, anti-establishment, but I'm also very old school showbiz in many ways. And
got the suit, but you're also,
that's
the other thing. It's on the suit, I guess. You know, alternative probably we associate with t-shirts, jeans, and with a suit and a tie. It doesn't quite fit. Maybe it doesn't quite fit. Well, that's great. I think that's why you're brilliant. I mean, are brilliant. I think it's the fact you don't
I'm glad
that,
this
that is what
yeah.
it is.
Yeah.
The not fitting is what it is, right?
It's yeah, in a sense, yeah.
But I want that suit to fit.
Yeah, yeah. It's true, yeah. No, it is. I mean, that's a very good way of summing it up, really. I think now that we're talking about me, probably we said thank you, Lee Mack, very much.
Thank you, Alexi. It's been an honour and a pleasure, and I look forward to receiving the check.
You can fuck off. Well, yeah, that was, I mean, as I said in the bit, really, we ended up talking about how great I am, which you can't, and that's, listen, people, that's just Lee Mack telling you how great I am, not just me, repeatedly telling you how great I am, which obviously I do because it's my podcast, but there's somebody else, somebody who's a family-friendly entertainer, but sees the extraordinary professional innovation that I brought and I'm still bringing to this field. And you're lucky to have me, really. You could do another plea for money, couldn't we, really, there? Say it again.
If you can't afford to, obviously, no pressure, man. Don't feel guilty. But if you can afford a few quid every month,
yeah,
the price of a cup of coffee, like they say,
Yeah.
Buy us a coffee a month or a beer a month or yeah. What's a £10 thing that people buy? Your Netflix subscription.
Yeah.
You're not giving to the corporate machine. You're giving to this.
There's such a shit movie on Netflix at the moment. The Union with Halle Berry and Mark Wahlberg. Oh, it's so shit in so many different ways.
As Eminem said, Mark Wahlberg is a small turd. I've not heard of The Union.
Yeah.
Halle Berry used to be a star who was only in top grade stuff. And what happened?
Yeah.
The Union.
Terrible. That's just a League of Terrible Gentlemen.
I saw that. The Guy Ritchie is a piece of shit. But
is that Guy
Ritchie?
Is it another Guy Ritchie?
Yeah,
film?
The League of Ungentlemanly. It's just it wants to be
He wants to be Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, in Something Bastards?
Quentin Tarantino is a shitbag himself, but I mean, except he did at least make My Friend Christoph famous.
Yeah.
But
that film desperately wants to be Inglourious Basterds.
Mm, exactly.
Nazi but that, hunting.
That just shooting people in the head for kind of comic effect it's really morally repulsive and
it's gross.
Yeah.
It's just shallow and unfunny.
Yeah.
I watched it late one night. I didn't smirk the whole time once.
It's awful. Beyond belief.
But it's got technically filmic, cinematically, it looks nice, which is kind of the biggest, it's the biggest lie of all. It's a con. It feels like I was being conned into carrying on watching.
Yeah, because the other thing it does is there's colorblind casting as well. That the lead heroes is a black guy. But it just all makes it worse. I think.
He was actually all right, though. I liked him.
Yeah, he was good. Yeah, I'd like to see him in something good rather than something evil and terrible.
Yeah. That's a pathetic film.
Anyway, we're getting quite a backlog, aren't we? We're sitting on, I don't know if Lenny's getting frustrated. That's a funny discussion about me advertising Premiere in.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've got Lenny in the can. Next, we're going to put out Andy Beckett, aren't we, really?
Correct. So we're sandwiching between two comedy icons.
Yeah.
Some politics for y'all.
Yeah.
Andy Beckett wrote a really interesting book. Maybe you could give the audience some homework and get them to read the book.
His book. Yeah, The Searchers. I was going to mention, I never mentioned to Andy Beckett that I didn't, because, if you do these podcasts, they will send you a free book, the publishers, but I'd actually bought.
You'd bought
his book of my own accord before, so I didn't have to.
And you read the book before the interview. So if our listeners want to be more prepared for next week, whenever it comes out, the next episode, By The Searchers by Andy Beckett.
Yeah.
Fascinating book about the history of the kind of rebels of the Labour Party, really. It's Ben, Corbyn, Abbott.
Ken Livingstone.
And written in a kind of really easily digestible manner, right?
Yeah.
And it covers psychology and history and politics, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, have a read of that if you'd like to be more prepared for next episode.
Yeah.
Although the homework is not mandatory.
No. Maybe you could Strangers on a Train is finished on Radio 4 now. Maybe you could bombard your BBC with requests for another Series 4. Mobilise my army of
fans. Right to points of view.
Yeah. Yeah, send a letter to points of view.
That show is so popular. A lot of people post about it online. I was on that train. Oh, I wish he talked to me. I ride that train every day.
Oh, really? We're waiting for them to commission another series. So.
Oh, it will come, won't it? What's next, though? Are you going to do one on a plane?
No, that's all. One of the frustrating things. We're making this podcast getting longer. But it's sort of frustrating in a sense, but sort of what's all you can do is what that show is. You can't make a book out of it.
Yeah.
You can't do it on telly. You can't change the format in any way at all, really. All you can, the beauty, I mean, that's the beauty of it, is that you get on a train and talk to people and there's nothing else you can do. It's got no, as far as that, because God knows we've thought about it, but it's got no areas where you could kind of expand the franchise, you know.
Series, you should try to interview the train driver if you can.
We interviewed the guy, the driver from Glasgow going down south. So we have done that, really.
Well, I just showed my ass then. I don't really listen to it.
Yeah, that you haven't listened to it. Sorry, I don't,
difficult
because you don't want to distract them, really.
Yeah, of course. You know how Lee Mack was saying how they used to reenact the young ones in the playground?
Yeah.
Do you think there's a playground out there now where there's two kids reenacting an interview from Strangers on the Train? You be the lady who's going to visit her cousin in Doncaster. I'll be Alexi Sale. they're acting it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess. I don't know how many young people listen to Radio 4, but yeah. Let's hope. Esperemos.
All right, then. Thanks for listening, listeners.
Yes, thank you. Bye-bye. See you soon. Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Alexi Sale podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkuti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.